Hello and welcome to the Rest Is History bonus episode, or as they say in America, Dominic, yeehaw.
Is that how they talk?
That is exactly how they talk in America. And right. I'm saying that because we are in Washington. We're in the capital of the free world. We're sitting outside, gorgeous sunny day, helicopters, all the usual sounds of the great capital city of America.
Yeah.
We arrived yesterday, and we probably by the time you hear this, we will have done our episode in Washington and we'll be in New York, won't we?
Well, we've done our live show, you mean?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so we arrived last night. We're down by the old Naval Yards. We're in a lovely bit of an AstroTurf park.
So great for wildlife.
Yeah, beautiful natural
Occasional
scene.
Occasional bird lands down and looks puzzled.
We sat in a different part this morning by the river, which I'm told is the Anacostia, not the Potomac. So the rest is history.
And it is Potomac, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not Potomac.
Yes. Although even Potomac, I think purists say there's some weird form of pronunciation that we're not adopting correctly. So we recorded two episodes this morning about the trials of Oscar Wilde. Just before we left, we did an episode about Hadrian and Antoninus. And of course, last week, Tom, so we've been traveling a lot, haven't we? I mean, we've spent a lot of time in each other's company.
It's been great.
Because last
I'm not
week,
in any way getting bored of you or your company.
So there's been an interesting twist in the Rest Is History's touring arrangements, which we'll come on to, or rather, he will come into it in a second. But because last week we were in Paris and Amsterdam. Sorry, there's a plane going overhead. You'll just have to bear with us for that. We're in Amsterdam and Paris, and you enjoyed that, didn't you, Tom?
Yeah, I had a lovely time. It was great fun. And we had Alex and Theo with us then, who were wonderful company.
They're great
company. Still with us.
Yeah. They're a delight. They make the whole trip incredibly easy. All the conversation is of a very high level.
It is a very elevated level,
but disastrously for the conversation. We flew out last night with our executive producer, the co-owner of Goalhanger, Tony Pasta,
who has, I think it's fair to say, lowered the tone
in a very significant ways, driven the conversation into the gutter, and he's with us now.
Tony, how do you plead?
I plead not guilty. Mr. Sandbrook on the plane decided he wanted to discuss culture. He wanted to discuss sexual preferences through the decades and the centuries and how they've changed and whether or not we're on history has an arc towards a more tolerant and liberal state.
The result
state.
Was carnage.
Yeah, and it resulted in a five-hour debate that had to be interrupted, frankly, by the air steward and so that other people could sleep.
So Tony, we'll put Tony back in his box now because Tony's going to resurface later.
You're going to ask us some questions,
aren't you?
Sure.
Yeah.
So Tony's going to get back into considering the history of sexuality. But in the meantime, Tom...
Which also, I mean, prompted by the fact that we've been doing these episodes on Oscar Wilde.
Oscar Wilde.
And on the Emperor Hadrian and his lover Antoninus.
But we're also in the middle...
There's a certain theme there.
We're in the middle. I'm sorry about the planes again. We're in the middle of our great Irish marathon. So... you should have episodes 3 and 4 of Ireland. Now, one quick thing, bit of housekeeping. We know that some of you didn't get both the episodes 1 and 2 straight away last week of Ireland. We had a few technical issues, and of course, we were on the road with the producers in Amsterdam and Paris.
But the people responsible have been shot.
Yeah.
So just to make that absolutely clear, they have paid the extreme penalty.
So those two episodes we did with Paul Rouse and the GPO, and we've got Dan Jackson, so he should be out now, and Paul's final episode.
On the Easter Rising.
And we had spent weeks, hadn't we, planning that Irish series.
Yeah.
Discussing the exact where we would break and who would do the episodes and all that kind of thing. And I think we were lucky with that in that we had two brilliant guests. Yeah. Didn't you?
I think we were lucky with Paul because I hadn't heard him speak before. But you had, is that right? You had heard him.
So I'd heard Paul at, I don't think we talked about this last week, did we?
No.
So we did an episode about George Orwell. Maybe 6 months ago, nine months ago, with a friend of mine called Robert Coles, historian at, used to be at Leicester, and then he became emeritus professor at De Montfort University in Leicester. And he's the author, not just of a biography of Orwell, but wonderful history of sport.
Which we talked about in the episode.
Well,
I loved that book.
And a brilliant book called Identity of England, about English identity in the last 200 years. And so Rob came on the podcast. He was brilliant on Orwell. And then... some months ago, Rob had a kind of retirement. It was a sort of festival of Coles in Leicester, where lots of speakers came to talk about different aspects.
How great he was.
Yes, basically, how great he was. And I was one of those. So I was talking about his book, Identity of England. And Paul Rouse was one of the speakers because he is the great historian of sport in Ireland. And he came along and he...
You know, he roasted him, is that
he
right?
Didn't quite roast him. So I think Rob may listen to these episodes. So he didn't roast him, but he was less... A lot of people just genuflected at the altar of Rob. But Paul said, oh, I disagree with you about this. I disagree with you about that. He was feisty. He was pugnacious. And I thought as I was listening to him, oh, he'd be great on The Rest Is History. And then I thought, why isn't he the person we've been looking for all this time to do Ireland for us? Because he's got this lovely, accessible, good-humoured, normal style, which is often not quite what you get from academics, actually. Paul, I remember when I dropped him an email, Paul rang me about 5 minutes later and said, I will come on the podcast and do Ireland, but on one condition, which is that you guys come to Dublin. I want to take you to the GPO. You know, it came from him to do all that.
Yeah.
And the result was great. I mean, I think that's
incredible privilege to do it in the GPO, wasn't it?
And definitely.
Taken up onto the roof.
Definitely.
And
it was really important, I think, for us to have an Irish voice, because I think there are some subjects on which you and I can get away with pontificating from afar. But I think English, you know, English public school boys talking about Irish history, it has a charge that is not entirely conducive to, you know, success and popularity.
Yes. And particularly when they're sitting in the GPO and they name Oliver Cromwell as a friend of the show, Dominic.
Or indeed correct their Irish guest from Derry to Londonderry.
I wasn't correcting him. I was merely pointing out for the benefit of the listeners.
As Paul says in the episode, that's quite the move, Tom. What did you say? That's quite the move.
I'm just pointing out that Derry can also be known as Londonderry. It's just point of information.
You know, the comedian Dara O'Brien.
Yes, he gave London Dara.
Yeah, he gave a fantastic show in Derry where he says, brilliant to be here. I'm Dara, or as you would say, London Dara.
Very good joke.
Yeah. So, and Dan Jackson. So Dan Jackson, who, you know, it was your idea to get Dan on board, wasn't it? Because you said, this is his PhD.
Yeah.
The Home Rule Crisis.
So Dan has done the North-South Divide. He was one of our earliest guests. Because his book on the Northeast, on... Geordie Land,
the Northumbria,
is really one. It's my favourite book of local history, I think. But I knew that he was also, you know, this was his mastermind subject.
Yeah.
So it seemed a no-brainer, really, that we get him on to talk about what the events in Ireland meant for the whole of the United Kingdom. And he was brilliant.
And anyway, back to Washington, Tom.
Yeah.
So where we're doing our show tomorrow night. So this is your first time in
Washington? It's my second time. So I came here, I made a film about the origins of Islam, and we had a Muslim scholar who we interviewed in Washington. So we came here, and it's one of those filming trips where we just kind of landed, stayed. I got to see the Holocaust Museum.
Right.
And I think that was basically it.
Right.
We had kind of, you know, a couple of hours, and we went off and did that.
And you're very excited because you're going on a tour of the Capitol tomorrow, aren't you?
Going on a tour of the Capitol tomorrow, and this afternoon when we finish this, I'm going to go and look at the dinosaurs in the Smithsonian.
Lovely. Very good.
Looking forward to that.
You know, I once lived in Washington for a few months. In 2000,
researching your doctorate,
researching my PhD, so I spent all my time in the National Archives,
which is a very handsome building, isn't it?
Yeah, there's
kind of the Roman Temple Archives vibe.
Yeah, but there's the main place where the scholars work is actually out in Bethesda, I think it is, University of Maryland.
Oh, that's disappointing.
Yeah, that's nice out there though, and the Library of Congress, did lots of work in the Library of Congress. I mean, it's about 20 years since I was in Washington. It's a funny city though. Because it's all low rise by American standards, because you can't build, I mean, American listeners will know this, but our British listeners maybe won't. You're not allowed to build higher than the top of the Washington Monument, which is this kind of obelisk piercing
it's
the sky.
Probably best thought of as the Canberra of America, right?
or the Ottawa of the United States, yeah. Yeah, because
it doesn't have an organic feel.
It doesn't have the organic feel, or indeed the sort of the electricity and the edge of somewhere like New York or Los Angeles or Chicago, you know, these big metropolises. It's not a big metropolis, actually. You know, it didn't take long to drive in from the airport. We drove that. Our taxi driver took us...
on a route past the White House.
Past the White House. So for Alex and Theo and indeed Tony, it was fun to see the White House and Capitol and all the monuments and stuff. You enjoyed that, didn't you, Tony?
I did, and I actually went for a run this morning. And I ran past the National Archive, I ran past the Capitol. And in fact, just before the Capitol building, there's a beautiful row of kind of houses you could almost see in a lovely part of Bristol or Edinburgh. Beautiful,
high praise low rise. Indeed.
And actually, the most surprising thing is that the city's almost deserted. I barely saw a soul. I ran past the White House down to the World War II memorial, and I probably saw a dozen people out. It was quite early. It was sometime between 7 and 8 in the morning on a Sunday, but still very quiet.
Because the centre is kind of monumental. It's just museums and iconic buildings.
And actually, when you get, so where we were for dinner last night, sort of downtown, as it were, that's all lobbyists, law firms, you know, it's involved with the world of politics. And actually, at the weekend or in the evening, it's really quiet.
Burglars, of course, heading off to Watergate.
The Watergate building.
One of my favourite crime writers is a guy called George Pelicanos, and he wrote a fantastic set of novels set here in Washington. But he wrote mostly about the Greek community that lives, as I understand it, in one of the suburbs of the city. And it just made 70s and 80s Washington sound hugely exciting, if slightly dangerous and edgy.
Yeah. But Washington is...
That's the Watergate vibe, isn't it?
It's the Watergate vibe, but also Washington is I mean, it's not an entirely undangerous city. I mean, there's a lot of poverty in Washington. Historically, there's often been quite a lot of crime. And it's also, I mean, people forget that it's right on the edge of the South. So there's a very large black community. And, you know, historically, there's been a lot of, race has always been an issue. In Washington. So tomorrow we're on the
border between the Union and the Confederacy.
Exactly,
here.
Exactly. So when we did the episodes with Adam Smith about the American Civil War, one of the things that I think newcomers to the American Civil War as a subject find extraordinary is that the two rival capitals, Washington and Richmond, are so close together, actually.
Yeah.
You know, right now we could drive to Richmond this afternoon easily and be there for afternoon tea. So I think that's an interesting thing. We're going to be doing an episode tomorrow, aren't we? On Tuesday morning at the Lincoln Memorial about Martin Luther King and his I Have a Dream speech, in which obviously race is absolutely the forefront.
There's a fascinating story I only heard last week while watching the new movie Air. Have you heard this movie? Air, it's about the attempt to sign Michael Jordan to Nike. Very, very, very early part of his career when he was clearly going to be a big breakout sporting success, but and Nike were the small disruptor. They weren't Adidas, they weren't New Balance. They came from nowhere really. And Jordan was their transformational figure. But one of the characters in the story, a fictionalized account of it, tells the story of the man who was handed Martin Luther King's speech. At the end of the speech, he was just given it. I think he was a security guard who attended that night. And he read it afterwards and was shocked to discover that the speech that Martin Luther King delivered bore very little resemblance to the one that was typed up on those pages. He was relatively recently offered huge amount of money to sell that, the original typed out speech with the amendments and scribblings on it. And he refused. He said, no, this is too important to me. No amount of money would take it away from me.
Well, we'll be talking about this when we do the episode, that the last section of the speech is improvised. I mean, he's using riffs.
Someone calls out, tell us your dream.
Tell us about the dream. So a gospel singer who had heard him use the dream formula in earlier speeches. And actually there are stories by some of the people standing around him. They're like, oh, no, not
the dream stuff again.
Yeah, but there is somebody who says, I said to myself, not for Christ's sake, not the dream. That's the lot. Because actually it was the end. Well, we'll do this in the episode, but it was the end of the day. A lot of people going home. They'd had 16 speeches, or I think they'd had 15 speeches already. It was the 16th speaker. And it was a very hot day. And people, you know, he was the final slot. But actually, in some ways, it was a bad slot.
The graveyard slot.
People were tired, bored, hot.
Yeah.
And and of course, as we all know, that's probably one of the two or three most famous pieces of oratory of the 20th century.
Yeah.
How long was it before he was assassinated, Dominic?
So the speech is in the late summer of, exactly, 1963, and he's assassinated in the summer of 1968, or the spring of 1968, I think it is. So, it's at the peak. The speech marks he reaches the peak of his popularity, kind of 63, 64, and then actually at the time when he's assassinated, his reputation is in decline.
But with
white America.
But also with black America, right?
Right,
to
because
a degree,
there's a radicalization of the
Black Panthers and Malcolm X.
Malcolm X, exactly. Yeah. So there's always this, I mean, Malcolm X is a presence, an offstage presence in even in 1963, that there are some people, younger people, who are more aggressive, more in, you know, yeah. more impatient, I suppose. This is a story about a guy called John Lewis, who became a congressman, very famous black civil rights leader, who was told to tone down his remarks at the March on Washington speech. At the last minute, he was basically forced to tone down his speech because he actually wanted to say, you know, mushy sentiments and kind of Hallmark greetings cards.
Don't butter any parsnips.
Right, that we have to be more impatient. We have to push for more. You know, he, in other words, even in 1963, Martin Luther King, there's a bit of pressure on him to beef it all up a bit and not to just settle for less, as it were.
So we'll be doing this.
Yeah, we will.
And then we are going to New York and we'll be doing the great power cut as a way into the theme of New York in the 70s.
New York in the 70s. So the city's financial collapse, the famous story that some people I know have already been talking about on the Discord for the Rest is History Club members, Ford to City, drop dead, was front page when they basically went begging Gerald Ford for a bailout. He actually did give them a bailout eventually.
Which is the film where New York gets turned into a penal colony and people have to escape.
Escape from New York.
Escape from New York. When
Kurt
is that
Russell.
Made?
It's about 1982, I think. There's
So that's very much informed by
very much.
The sense of New York as an urban dystopia.
Well, even more so, Taxi Driver, 1975, and a film called The Warriors, which is all about gangs.
Which is all about Xenophon. It's about the Anabasis.
Well, we're going to talk about this in the episode.
Great. Last.
So this is yet another, Tom, it's a bit of an offcut from the Sandbrook history of 70s America.
Oh, I love that.
So
like the fall of Saigon.
Like the fall of Saigon.
So was this completely cut as well, this chapter?
I can't actually remember now. I think a lot of it was cut.
Well.
It's a fascinating
story.
So
your publisher's loss is the listener's gain.
It's the world's gain.
Yes.
Right. Now, Tony, I think you have a load of questions for us from Rest is History Club members.
Okay, question number one. My question for Tom and Dom, this is from Connor, would be, which historical battle was more impactful? The Siege of Vienna, 1683, or the Battle of Tours, 732.
So, Dominic, just before that, should I just explain what the battles are?
Do, yeah.
Okay, so both are kind of seismic episodes in the history of the relationship between the House of Islam and Christendom. The first, the Muslims who have conquered Spain and have broken across the Pyrenees, are crossing into Gaul, into the Kingdom of the Franks. And they're met by Tor, actually very near the site of the battle that the Black Prince wins many centuries later. Theo, the Frenchman, rolls his eyes at that. But on this occasion, the Franks are victorious and the invasion is repelled. And then the Siege of Vienna, it's the onslaught of the Ottomans against the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Vienna is put under siege and that siege fails. And it is seen as being a kind of the high tide for Ottoman expansion into Europe. And from that point on, it's pretty much a continuous process of retreat for the Ottomans. So there's a kind of certain similarity between them.
There is. And I think in both cases, my argument would be, even if those battles go the other way, the aggressor, as it were, the Muslim power, is right at the point of overextension anyway. Mm. So let's say late 17th century Vienna had fallen. Is it plausible that the Ottoman Empire would have continued going into the heart of Central Europe? I think they're at their limit, as it is. So they might have occupied Vienna for a little bit, but then they would have fallen back again eventually. So ultimately, I don't know. Supposedly that's the siege that gives rise to croissants.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
That the Austrians invented croissants. We always think of them as French. Sorry, Theo, this is bad news for you with your croissant mongering. But that they're inspired by the crescent. But the Viennese bakers created croissants. I believe the story is an utter lie and a myth.
I believe so, yes. Yeah. I mean, it absolutely has the sound of that, doesn't
but
it?
But it's exactly the kind of story we like to tell on The Rest is History. But I think of the two, I don't think either of them are actually as significant as people think, but maybe Tommy will tell me that the Battle of Tours was more significant.
So the Battle of Tours is famous for enthusiasts for counterfactuals because it inspires Gibbon to come up with one of the most famous, and he says that had the Battle of Tours gone the other way, then there would have been nothing to stop Muslim fleets from sailing up the Thames.
That's
and
right.
He has something along the lines of, and perhaps today,
in the minarets of Oxford,
preachers would proclaim the prophethood of Muhammad to a circumcised people.
Yeah,
which is obviously a Gibbonian joke at the expense of the teachers at Oxford, which he despised. He had a terrible time at Oxford. I think the Battle of Tours is slightly more important because and I quite like to do an episode on this actually, because the state structures, whether it's the Austro-Hungarian Empire or the kingdoms that lay beyond it, by the early modern period are very strong, and the European mastery of warfare is really starting to kick in. So I completely agree on that point, that I think that it wouldn't really have made a great difference. I think things are slightly different in the 8th century.
Kind of more fluid.
Much more fluid, and the what becomes the Carolingian monarchy. So Charlemagne, for instance, the great Frankish king who becomes emperor in AD 800, he's a descendant of Charles Martel, Charles the Hammer, who wins the Battle of Tours. That monarchy would probably never have been founded. And so Frankish power would have been a lot more unstable. And
right.
Really, the Frankish Empire becomes the kind of bedrock on which the structures of Christendom are built, the kind of state structures of Christendom are built. So I think it would have probably been more decisive.
Let's try and, well, just some more questions and we'll both try to give quicker answers, because I know you've got to go and see your dinosaurs.
I have.
So, right, I've got a good one for you, Dominic, from Simon Girdlestone.
Oh yeah, I know Simon Girdlestone.
Why didn't Richard Nixon cut the Watergate conspirators loose immediately after the news of the burglary broke? They were demonstrably incompetent and unhinged lunatics, in John A. Fowle's words. And from the Hiss case, Nixon knew it was the cover-up that gets you. Indeed, he said that to his aides at the time.
Right, but cut them loose how? I mean, if they exposed their links with Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy and the committee to re-elect the president, that's very embarrassing for him. So it's much better for him, I think, to hush them up, pay them off, yeah, keep them quiet, keep them happy, keep them quiet. That's his thinking. And it's only when James McCord, I think it is, who breaks the story, who basically cracks, that it all really begins to come out. So in other words, you could argue that that's a strategy that could have worked. You could have paid them off, kept them happy. End of story, we wouldn't be having the conversation today. But I think cutting them loose just ensures that they will talk to prosecutors and that the links will come out. So it kind of, his strategy in some ways is the obvious one.
Because presumably cover-ups do work. Because there must have been cover-ups that we've never heard about.
Yeah, I suppose so, yes. I mean, it's an impossible position, Tony, at that point.
One of our other podcasters, Alistair Campbell, recently explained what the definition of a crisis is and how you are supposed to solve it. His definition is that it's a situation which threatens to overwhelm the organization.
Yeah.
And his suggested method for solving a crisis is to work out where you want to get to by the end of it,
yeah,
and get there as quickly as possible. So in other words, if it is to say, sorry, we've got this wrong, we're going to have an inquiry or whatever it might be, you do it immediately. You don't wait for it to be dragged out over time.
You can't do that with burgling and bugging your
opponent's, or indeed with invading Iraq.
Your opponent's headquarters. And the other thing is, from Nixon's point of view, the end game is to win the election. And he makes the problem go away and he wins that election on a landslide. So at the end of 1972, he might well say, our strategy worked. It's very successful.
Yeah. Right, this one's for Tom. Harold Stassen. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. Tom, if you could get your hands on one piece of lost ancient literature, what would you pick?
Oh, that's a great question. That's a great question. Agrippina, who was the mother of Nero, the niece and wife of Claudius, wrote an autobiography, which then very much informed Tacitus's history. But that would be amazing. We don't have any first-person histories or biographies or narratives from women. And she was such a seismic figure in the history of early Roman Empire that it would be wonderful to have that.
Very good. Jesse B. I finally finished Andrew Roberts' fantastic Napoleon. I never realized there were so many assassination attempts on Napoleon's life. An exploding cart nearly killed him in 1800. What happens in the world if Napoleon dies in 1800?
Crikey, in 1800. So Napoleon is at the very beginning, really, of his political career. I think the truth of the matter is that the struggle between France and Britain for global mastery, that is going to happen and be resolved one way or the other eventually. So Napoleon dies, the revolutionary regime, or as it's becoming, it's moving from being a revolutionary regime into an imperial regime. Someone else would pick up the reins. Without Napoleon's military genius, maybe France doesn't expand as much. France probably still loses in the long run, embattled by so many foes. But I suppose the interesting thing is Napoleon doesn't get to export the ideas of the French Revolution.
Yeah, I mean, that's the key, isn't it?
The much-hated metric system, Tom.
Yes.
And those ideas of the revolution.
The Code Napoleon.
The Code Napoleon. So that does make a difference. So in other words, it makes a very big difference to Germany, to Italy.
And to the Netherlands.
To the Netherlands.
So we talk about this in our episode on Amsterdam.
We do, yeah. So I think that's the big difference, that actually the non-export. Although, would French revolutionary ideals have been exported anyway?
And maybe Nelson would have lived, which is also an important consideration.
But we wouldn't have done a three-part series.
So that's
about Trafalgar.
Yeah, so the reverberations ripple out deep.
Okay, final question, guys. Alex F. If Goalhanger, i.e., I guess he means the producers, or she means the producers, said that you could do an episode where you don't have to worry about a good title or audience appeal or even the approval of your co-presenter, you can just do one episode on something you really want to do, what would you both pick?
Dominic knows I really want to do an episode on Gregory the VII, the great revolutionary pope of the 11th century. I think Europe's greatest revolutionary, the man who humbles the emperor at the gates of Canossa. And although Dominic has been obdurate against allowing me to do this so far, I am hopeful that I'll be
very
able
happy
to wear him down.
To confirm for us as history listeners that episode absolutely will be appearing on the show, and it will appear exactly 1 week after I'm dead. So you've got that to look forward to. What would I choose?
I might have to poison him.
Well, I tell you an episode that I've always talked about doing, and Tom is a little bit wary. I'm obsessed with school stories. I've written about them, as you know, Tom, in the Great British Dream Factory.
Yes.
I think they are
boarding school stories.
They are a uniquely British genre. Of course, the most famous school stories now are Harry Potter. You know, loved all over the world. And what people don't know, I would imagine 99% of Harry Potter fans don't know, is how closely those stories are modelled on the Victorian school stories from Tom Brown's school days onwards. And the school stories that in the first part of the 20th century were by far the most influential and important for about three generations of British boys. So Aneurin Bevan, Tony, who you probably admire, being a great Labour man,
indeed,
the founder of the National Health Service, when he was a boy, he was a Welsh mining community, he was told off by his father for reading what he regarded as trashy literature, and he would hide these comics under a railway bridge to go and read them. And you know what they were? They were the Billy Bunter stories, A Greyfriars School, the classic boarding school stories.
The Fat Owl of the
Remove. The Fat Owl of the Remove. And the fact that they were particularly popular with working class boys who would never have dreamed of going to boarding school. And there's a wonderful book called The Intellectual Life of the British Working Classes by a guy called Jonathan Rose. An absolutely wonderful book. And in that, he has lots of examples of working class kids who later go on, maybe through grammar schools or through working their way up, to become articulate kind of literary people. And again, they say, I got my moral code, my sense of the world, from these school stories. So I think it's a fascinating subject.
So I think that there is scope there for possible negotiation. I mean, I'm very happy to do that, to let you do that, if you will let me do Canossa.
It's a high price for me to pay, Tom, sit through an hour of Gregory the VII. But the scope for further negotiations, and we've got Alistair Campbell. Tony can bring Alistair Campbell in as a kind of negotiator.
To sort it out.
Yeah.
Because
didn't he single-handedly, certainly by his own account, bring peace to Northern Ireland, Tony?
I don't think he would claim it was single-handedly. I think he would certainly say he played a small part, but I think Bill Clinton played a very large part, and here we are in his homeland.
Well, maybe we could get Clinton and Alistair Campbell together to
negotiate the crucial
Bunter.
So
who knows, ladies and gentlemen?
Gregory deal.
get a Canossa Greyfriars mashup.
Tony is itching to speak about
something. I've got one question. Is it true that there are parts of the US where Harry Potter is disapproved of?
I think that's slightly exaggerated, don't you, Tom? There's a claim that basically it was disapproved of as devil-worshipping
wizardry.
There are now two Black constituencies magic. That disapprove
right,
of it.
True.
So there's the kind of hardcore Christian wing that see it all as satanic and sorcery. And then there's the others that see J.K. Rowling as evil for her views on gender theory.
But I have to say that the last time I was in the United States before this visit was, as older listeners or long-time listeners will know, was to Orlando, Florida, where they've at the Universal Studios, they have Hogwarts and all of that business, the Harry, the Hogwarts Express. They've rebuilt, you know, amazing. And I have to say, judging by the massive, massive crowds, J.K. Rowling's popularity in Florida, she's a long way from being cancelled among the Florida tourist community.
Well, they're about to do a TV version of Harry Potter, aren't they?
They are indeed, so. Well, she enjoys, doesn't she, going onto social media. And, you know, now she positively baits people by saying, oh dear, I'm doing so badly. I only made $27 billion last year. Well done. Your cancellation tactics are working so well.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's...
Anyway, lots to look forward to.
You've got your dinosaurs to go and see, Tom.
Gregory the Seventh and Boarding School Stories coming your way. You heard it here first. All right. So thanks ever so much for listening. Lots to come. We've got Hadrian Antoninus, haven't we?
Wild,
next week,
Oscar Wilde.
We've got Oscar Wilde. Then we've got Amsterdam and we've got Paris.
Lovely.
So lots to look forward to.
Lovely. Okay. All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.